Right, okay, so we are going to explore this final talk on our little introduction to Kabbalah. And you notice that here is the outline of the course. Hope it's clear. Yeah. So there you have the previous talks, History of the Kabbalistic Tradition, Torah Study and Mitzvot, Prayer, Meditation, Shabbat and Marriage, and now finally the global perspective, from creation to redemption, the Jew and the world. Okay, so the question is what we're actually exploring. Let me put it this way. See, there's a way of understanding Jewish life, or life as a whole, on the basis of the pleasure principle. If, with the help of God, things work out more or less all right, a person has an enjoyable life, or this little bit of life is enjoyable, and he or she doesn't worry too much, you know, about what was and what's going to be. You know, it's comfortable at this moment. Yes, you know, there might be all kinds of threatening clouds on the horizon, but you don't worry about it. You try not to worry about it, and maybe it'll be good anyway. Another way of thinking about life is that it actually has a purpose, that there's a direction, there's a process, something is happening. And the interesting thing is, that there are lots of ways of thinking about process in this sense. Jewish teaching has the idea of a process. There are quite a number of secular systems of thought which also have the idea of a process, that one is moving on, that there are different stages. You know, the whole evolutionary concept, even though on one level that conflicts with religious teaching, you know, God created the world with all the animals as they are, etc. But the idea that there is movement, there's some kind of advance, there's some sense of discovery, that something is being achieved, and that what's happening now is new, and there's a new dimension that can be achieved now. That's a very, very interesting Jewish concept, especially when we look at the mystical and Kabbalistic tradition. That actually conflicts with a very popular Jewish concept called Yeridat HaDorot, the descent of the generations. So according to the idea of the descent of the generations, as the Talmud puts it, if the earlier figures were angels, like the earlier rabbis, Hillel, Shammai, we are like men, and if the earlier figures were men, we are like donkeys. And we're not like the donkey of Rabbi Pinchas, the son of Yair, who had a wonderful donkey that was once stolen by thieves, and they had to let it go because it refused to eat food which hadn't had tithes taken from it, and it refused to work on Shabbat. So in the end, they just sent it back. So we're like donkeys and not like that very special donkey. So that's the idea of Yeridat HaDorot, the descent of the generations, and people getting less and less. And so we are smaller than the people of the past. So if so, how could you say that we have greater possibilities than the people in the past? Can anyone make a suggestion? There's a very interesting image which is in Jewish thought, and you can also find it elsewhere as well.
Sorry, Tim, when you say we're smaller, do you mean in religious and spiritual?
Yes, in some sense.
We're lower.
Yeah, we're more puny.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, we if you want to evaluate how big we are, can we make a decision? And keep You know, one gets the feeling that when you're looking at one of the scholars of the 16th century, lived in Suffolk, you know, if they decided they're going to do this from now on, they really did it. We decide very firmly this is what we're going to do, and then a week later you say, you know what, not quite. So that whole sense of impermanence about ourselves, so that makes us small. So in which way could we be smaller and yet be facing a new vista which no one else ever faced before? All right, I'll tell you, it's a very simple image. A dwarf on the shoulders of a giant. The previous generations are like a giant. We are like a dwarf, but we're standing on the shoulders. So we are therefore looking ahead, and we're able to see into the distance. Now, it's particularly in the Kabbalistic dimension, the inner dimension. See, if you look on the left over there, we've got two aspects of Torah. What's generally called the revealed Torah, in Hebrew, Nigle, the revealed, Mishnah, Talmud, code of law, the basic structure of Jewish teaching, which explains how to keep Jewish law, how to live a Jewish lifestyle, what does it mean, we're now coming to Pesach, how does a person organize Pesach, organize a Seder, that's all part of the straightforward Jewish teaching. Then we have the inner dimension, Kabbalah. And the way that I teach the Kabbalistic tradition, it's particularly as it's expounded in Chabad teaching, so I know exactly the route, you know, I know exactly the road, that there was this teacher, that teacher, the other teacher comes down, I can identify the books and the whole structure. They explain the kavana, the meaning, the effect, and the purpose of what we have on the left of keeping Jewish law, living a Jewish lifestyle. So in other words, keeping law, keeping Jewish teaching, living a Jewish lifestyle, running a Jewish home, having Shabbat, having Pesach, having Kashrut, all that is wonderful. It could just be seen as a very beautiful pleasure principle experience. If you want to enjoy life, have kosher food, it's all better when it's got a flavor of kashrut around it and the whole dimension of Jewish teaching. It's actually more, it's more wholesome, it's a very, it makes it a more lovely and a more lasting experience. And that's a very good selling point for Judaism in today's world. However, there is not only this pleasure principle concept, there is also an effect and a purpose, a cosmic purpose. That in some sense there are transformations taking place. And so if we imagine levels of effect, here we are, we're keeping a Jewish lifestyle, we're doing the different things that the code of law tells us to do. Now at the center, we have the individual. And the individual is tremendously significant. And we can have, you see there too, you have the idea of an effect and a process. There are transformations that we go through as a person. You know, keeping Pesach is actually a psychological journey, an extremely interesting psychological journey, the steps towards getting rid of the chametz from a person's home, and then it comes on the Sunday night, looking the traditional way, looking for the chametz around the house with a candle. And then on Monday morning, there's a beautiful traditional concept of burning the chametz. You take a little bit of chametz that was found, or some pieces that were put around, and then you found them, like one person puts them out, and the other person looks and finds them. And you burn them, and there is a sense of inner purification. And we enter into the whole Seder night, there's some deep, wonderful transformation taking place inside us. So just on the level of being an individual, there is actually a journey taking place. And that journey, it's a journey in the present as well as a very traditional concept, the idea that if you do mitzvot in this world, then you get a better world to come. You get a nice, beautiful experience in the Garden of Eden after 120 years, because you live life in this world in a good way. So that's a typical, that's in Pirkei Avot and many, many places. But there's also the idea of a process right now, that there's some sense of inner liberation, inner discovery, inside the person himself or herself. And in fact, one of the concepts when we're looking at the idea of redemption is an inner redemption. Just the idea of a person within himself finding this step of redemption. Now, my wife once had a student who was doing a PhD on people who had had plastic surgery on their noses. And he was a Jewish American, I think, as I remember him. And he had this wonderful theory that people feel in some kind of inner exile because of their anxiety about their nose, which gets them to the point that they're actually going to have plastic surgery on their nose. And then they have the surgery. And then they feel redemption. They have gone free. They're suddenly released. So there is this wonderful sense of redemption. You're just on this sort of physical, apparently it's not really just physical. It's a whole, many, many different dimensions together. But you can have that aspect of redemption, and you can have the quality of inner freedom that makes a person feel liberated. That sense of liberation. One way, in fact, of looking at Pesach is of a whole process of liberation, inner liberation of the person. That Pesach is actually not only once a year, there's a sense in which it's every day. There is the idea of Pesach, of going free and of this inner liberation. So one can look at it within oneself. So there we have right the bullseye of this this diagram. But then we have around it, let's say, the family. It's not only one's own trip. It's something you try to bring your whole family together with you. It's something liberating not only for you as an individual, but your spouse and your children and the people around you. Somehow you're making this little extra quality. I know some families who live in places very, very remote from other traditional Jews. And they make in their home a most beautiful Jewish atmosphere, which can have this whole liberating aspect, even though they're surrounded by people who do not understand that, and maybe very far from other Jews altogether. I know one family, they live in a village in Sweden, or a little town, and somehow or other business has brought them to that town, and that's where they are making a living. And it's very hard to move for them, but in their home is this beautiful cradle of spiritual atmosphere. And outside are the Swedish Gentiles with their, who do not understand what they're doing at all. And so there you have the famine. Take it a step further. There's effects within community. You could have movements within a community. The community where you live might be that there are lots of people and people are doing things together, this community itself, South Hampstead, people coming, people studying, interesting ideas being presented. So there's that level of transformation. Take it beyond, there might be currents in the Jewish people as a whole, themes which suddenly become important for the Jewish people at a particular moment in history. Suddenly everyone is talking about this or about that. And even general society. Take it beyond the Jewish people. Take it into, make it something global, something general society altogether where we are and perhaps everywhere in the world as a whole. And perhaps there needs to be another circle around this, not just the physical world, but the spiritual cosmos as well, some kind of transformation, liberation taking place. So you can have the idea that the action that a person is doing over here in this room, or the thought that is going on in someone's head, is actually percolating through all these different levels of existence, of life, of human life, and beyond into the world. Let's imagine that the world includes the physical world, spiritual domain. This idea of a knock-on effect, it's very interesting that quantum mechanics and similar ideas in modern physics talk about things being interrelated in the way people, the certain kind, you've heard of the butterfly effect. That's a butterfly flapping its wings in one place causes a storm or something in another place. So there are all these interrelations. There's a old Yiddish phrase that the a rabbi who is in sort of a religious environment. I think the story is Vilna. So there's a rabbi in Vilna. So Vilna was a place full of yeshivot and Torah study. So the rabbi in Vilna has to live up to a certain high standard, so that the daughter of the apothecary in Paris doesn't marry out, because we're all interconnected. So he has to try to climb to a higher level in some way, and because we are all interconnected, so someone who is down the ladder in a sense, and this girl living in a very secular environment at the same time, and her father he's running an apothecary, a chemist shop in Paris, and she's exposed to all kinds of different challenges. So in order to keep her within the Jewish fold, the rabbi has to somehow make some step forward in Vilna, right? So that's the image that we have over here of interconnectedness and effect. And so we could see that going further and further and further. The idea, in fact, Maimonides puts this in a very interesting way, which I think we mentioned at some earlier point, but it's a fascinating concept that in the 12th century he should write about it in this way, not obviously in the Kabbalistic tradition. There's a whole argument about Maimonides' relationship with the Kabbalah. But he writes that a person should consider themselves equally balanced between good and bad, and the whole world as equally balanced between good and bad, and therefore one's next action has the power to tip the world, oneself and the world, either this way or that way. And so that idea of keep having the whole world in one's hands, and if you make a movement in this direction, it's going to tip everything that way, or the opposite. That's a very, very Kabbalistic concept, really, that we are holding everything in our hands, and it depends on each of us completely, that everything depends on, you know, you. You are the active person, and everything depends on you and the whole state of existence. And the Lubavitcher Rebbe, commenting on this, he said, Maimonides speaks about an action, but one could say even a thought. Just the thought within a person's mind could tip the whole world in a positive direction. So we're talking now about this idea of process, purpose, and here we have some basic questions. What is existence? You see, where are we? What kind of situation are we in? This fascinates the philosopher, and as we come to different dimensions of philosophy, there may be the same questions but very different answers at different points. Does it have a purpose? And if yes, can you say what purpose? Can I help the achievement of that purpose? And if so, how? You know, these are, do you think those are relevant questions? I mean, a person might say, I'm not interested in those questions. I want to know where I can get the latest model computer. And will she marry me? But see, the psychologist Viktor Frankl was a very interesting person. He was the originator of a system of psychotherapy called logotherapy. He already had the system in his mind when he was, unfortunately, together with many other Jews, taken into a concentration camp in the war. But he used his therapeutic system in order to help other people whom he came in contact with in the camps. And the basic concept of logotherapy is that if you have a sense of purpose, you're able to keep your balance. If you haven't got a sense of purpose, then the person might just collapse because they haven't got any direction, particularly in the very, very extreme conditions that people were in a concentration camp. In normal life, people might get by without a clear sense of purpose. You know, you go to school, you go to university, you get this kind of job, that kind of job, have a boyfriend, have a girlfriend, maybe we'll get married, maybe not. There isn't necessarily a driving theme in the person's life. But when people are in very, very intense and dangerous and critical situations, like in Auschwitz or something like that, where death is a hairbreadth away, not only because the German or the whoever it is going to shoot the person, but because the person will not be quick enough to stay alive. That there's something that has to be done, and if one isn't positive enough, in a sense, the of course one might be very positive and still get shot or gassed as millions were, but he saw a phenomenon which in those days they called Musulmänner, people who we would call it today zombies, who became zombies and as such were very quickly, I mean, in deeply clinically depressed. But as such, they were very likely to get finished off for one reason or another. They didn't have the that strength to make. See, in the Holocaust, there was what's called Kiddush HaChaim, the sanctification of life, that the step to live another hour or another day is an incredibly demanding step. And for that one needs, he felt, a very strong sense of purpose. Well, so, you know, there's this idea of how many principles of faith are there. Maimonides wrote 13 principles of faith. So other people criticized Maimonides. They said, you can't just reduce it to 13 principles. The Talmud and the sages say many different things. You've got to believe all of it. So it's every detail you've got to believe in. Other people said, 13 principles is too much. You could say that there are some principles which are absolute key, vital principles, and others are secondary. You could perhaps reduce it all to one article of faith. There is a purpose. If you say that, you've got a whole religious, spiritual package. You've got the Torah, you've got God at Mount Sinai, you've got the written Torah, the oral Torah, the prophets, the sages, the reward and punishment, everything else that's there in Maimonides' 13 principles, it's there. In that one statement, there is a purpose. See, if we're able to imagine that, because a person might feel, is there a purpose? I don't know. Now, let me give you a non-Kabbalistic, non-Hasidic answer to these questions. What is existence? I don't know. Does it have a purpose? Yes, but I don't know what. If yes, what is that purpose? I don't know. Can I help the achievement of that purpose? Maybe. How? Through keeping Torah mitzvah. You see, the end result's the same. Keeping Torah mitzvah, you can have, whoever you are in the Jewish world, you can feel that keeping Torah mitzvah, you get up in the morning, there are blessings to be said, and there is davening, and there is everything that a person does during the day, and they earn money, they're going to give charity from the money they earn. It's all part of some total purpose, but I don't know exactly how it all fits together. And you know what? I don't need to know. It's too much if I would know any of the details. It would be too much. You know, I can argue this very, you know, for example, you can say, look, I have to eat. I don't have to know every detail of biology and what happens to the food when I eat in order for me to be able to have basically a healthy diet and live as a normal human being. So why do you have to look, you know, why look under the cover, as it were? But you see, from the point of view of the Kabbalist, the Hasid, the one who is looking for that meaning, it is the sense of what is under the cover which actually helps you face the challenges which are there. Now, the person who, you know, he's got a basically healthy diet, does he smoke? Well, maybe he smokes. How are you going to stop him smoking? Well, you might show him the, you know, some microscope slides of, you know, bits of the inside of a person which is affected by smoking. And you know what? I'm going to stop, you know, perhaps, you know, if that works. I don't know whether it works. It's, I've never met anyone who actually stopped smoking because of that. It was all some sort of other reason. But that sense, you see, Frankl's idea that if you have a sense of purpose, it helps you face the challenges of the moment. I would say that the Kabbalistic Hasidic approach is taking that and applying it to life, that we need to know a little bit of the whole mechanism within. Incidentally, the Lubavitcher Rebbe liked Frankl's writings and recommended them to a number of different people. So, okay, we're looking at the first question, what is existence? Okay? Bereshit bara Elokim, in the beginning God Elokim created. Now, you know, there are different words for the name of God, and Elokim expresses the attribute of severity. The creation of the universe was, or is, because there's an idea that creation is a continuous process, a step of self-concealment of the infinite divine. The idea is that there is the infinite oneness, the infinite radiance or beyond radiance of God, which is then hidden, and that enables the creation of the universe as we know it, this finite realm. And what is the purpose in this finite realm? Well, when we look at different places within the mystical, the Kabbalistic tradition, and as concretized in statements in Tanya, this very powerful Hasidic work written 200 years ago, of which there's a manuscript in the British Library, looking after it, there are only about 10 manuscripts in the world, and this one is here in Britain, there's one in Israel, and the others are in New York. But it's a very, very interesting work. And this, here we have this statement. What is the divine purpose? Dira lo yitbarach b'tachtonim. A dwelling for God, may he be blessed, in this lower world. God created the world in order there should be a dwelling for the divine in this lower realm. This was written by Rabbi Shneur Zalman of Lodz. And it's a book which has been translated into English. It's available in English. In fact, there's a bilingual edition with Hebrew one side and English the other. And it was published in 1796. And it encapsulates the mystical and Hasidic tradition in the first section as it applies to the individual, and he describes different aspects of the soul within the person, the divine soul and the animal soul, and how they are in a state of tension together. And he also, in the second section, talks about the nature of existence, the spiritual dimension of existence, the divine quality within existence. And the third section is about repentance. So that's, then there's a fourth and a fifth section, but it's a very powerful work. So here in this work, what's the purpose from the point of view of God? In order there should be a dwelling for the divine in the lower realm. Now, a lower realm means a realm where godliness is hidden. That's what's meant by a lower realm. A higher realm is where godliness is more revealed. So, the higher and higher, you know, you would imagine if you were making a kind of a diagram or a painting expressing higher and higher realms, you know, the Jacob's ladder image of going to higher levels, the Kabbalistic worlds, which we've spoken about a number of times in this course, the lower realm of action, then formation, then creation, then emanation, then finally the infinite Ein Sof. It's as if you're reaching higher levels of translucence, of radiance, divine radiance. The lower realm is where God is actually hidden. And it's in that hidden realm that God wants to be revealed. But there is a great problem, because lo yirani ha'adam b'chai, man cannot see me and live, as it says in the Torah, in the book of Exodus, when Moses asks, he's together, he's on Mount Sinai, he wants to come very close to God, man cannot see me and live. In other words, a person cannot come too close. It's the infinity of God will explode the finitude of man and of existence as a whole. So therefore, the process of existence is one of concealment. And so when we ask, what is the world? What is existence? What is the created realm in which we find ourselves? Well, it's called Ha'olam in Hebrew. But do you see, it's got the same letters as the Hebrew word helem, which means concealment. So Ha'olam is the world, or it could be the universe, but the world has the same letters as the word helem, which means concealment. So in fact, existence is a realm of concealment of God, and in this realm there is a goal. Now this goal, which is written over here, I could have spent a little bit longer, like finding, you know, exactly where I would get a nice quotation from Tanya, it might have been, or the Lubavitcher Rebbe's selected talks, or some other mystical work. But in fact, I just made it up, as it were, encapsulating what is the general stream of these teachings. That the ultimate goal of existence is that in the finite realm of the creation, Briyata Olam, called the lower world, here in our lower world, which, where godliness is hidden, the divine radiance and essence will be revealed, recognized by us, by human men and women, with life, peace, and joy in a positive way. That's the goal. That is the spiritual goal. That's the purpose of existence. Yes?
I was going to say, following up what you just said, then the goal in itself will never completely be realized.
Go on.
Well, you just said the problem is a man cannot see me and live. So in its totality, the goal will never be quite realized, unless, I don't know if that's related to Mashiach or something changes. But
you're absolutely right that it's a paradoxical goal. It's a difficult goal. The way that I imagine it is like you have to build a bridge across the River Thames. Okay? So we're going to build a bridge. The bridge will have to be built on columns. The columns will be made of cement. How can you get cement to fix in the water? You have to do something to keep the water out. You have to make a kind of, a sleeve or something, which will keep the water away, and then you can start building these columns, and you let the columns set, and finally you've got these strong concrete columns on which the bridge can be built. And you take away the sleeve that you had, which was keeping the water out, and now the column is able to stand despite the water. In other words, you needed a level of concealment in the world in order to be able to build a structure which can take that radiance of the divine. Because although the divine is something very, very intense, we also have the divine inside us. And the Torah and the mitzvot are the interface which is, as it were, preparing us and preparing the structure so that we will be able to be bathed in this divine radiance. And a further idea is that the long exile that we have gone through and the many terrible, terrible tribulations that we have experienced, not only as a people, but as individuals, is all preparing us that we should be able to take the intensity of that radiance. So you're absolutely right that it's a difficult task. And when I was writing these words, I wondered whether to put in the paradoxical goal. Because it is a paradox in terms of this logic. And yet, nonetheless, as you yourself said, that's what Mashiach and Geula, redemption, is about, the idea of this paradox being realized and the finite and the infinite being able to coexist, that the finite should become a vessel for the infinite without being exploded by the intensity of the experience. Of course, it does sound a bit idealistic, it sounds like a tremendous feat. Is it as tremendous as the possibility of space travel or the World Wide Web or other aspects of modern life? Who knows? But it's got this grand sense of power about it. Now, in order to attempt a little bit to explain this properly, rather than rely on myself summarizing things, I'm actually going to be quoting a particular book. And this is a book, Ba'ati Legani, Bosi Legani, I've Come Into My Garden, a Kabbalistic Hasidic tract by Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson. There's a picture of him. He passed away in 1950. He was the sixth Chabad Rebbe. His successor, his son-in-law and successor, is the famous Lubavitcher Rebbe that people have heard of, probably. But he is his predecessor. And he wrote this book, Ba'ati Legani, and the ideas there are what I'm going to try to share with you in the next few minutes. Because that talks about the whole redemptive goal and purpose of life. Now, Ba'ati Legani, Achoti Kala, I have come into my garden, my sister, my bride. It's a beautiful line in the Song of Songs, written by King Solomon. And the beauty of the Song of Songs is that Rabbi Akiva said all the sacred books of the Tanakh, of the Bible, are sacred, but Song of Songs is Kodesh Kodoshim, it's Holy of Holies, because it tells of the intimate relationship between God and the Jewish people. And the Midrash explains on this verse, Midrash Rabbah, in fact several different Midrashim, it's an interesting question, because there are quite a few Midrashim which say the same thing. They explain that the garden, Ba'ati Legani, it means the garden of the world, which originally meant the Garden of Eden. There's the Garden of Eden, this beautiful idea that originally there is the Garden of Eden. But the verse, Ba'ati Legani, I've come into my garden, refers to a later time. The moment that the divine presence was revealed in the sanctuary built by Moses and the Jewish people at Mount Sinai. At this point, the divine presence returned to the garden. The Lubavitcher Rebbe, commenting on this, said, well, that means our world is really a garden. That's the goal, to see the world as a garden. It often doesn't look like a garden. We see very terrible things in the world. But actually, deep down, it is a garden. And the whole process of existence is to discover the garden, not only for oneself, but for everyone in the world. That there is this garden, this beautiful dimension. And the thing is that the history of the Garden of Eden, if we go back to the Garden of Eden, well, it's a very interesting taste. It gives an image of the goal of creation, because there in the Garden of Eden, Adam and Eve were together with the divine presence. That's the whole image there in the Torah, this beautiful garden with rivers and trees and Adam and Eve together. It was the most wonderful thing, with the divine presence with them. There they were, together with the divine. That's actually the goal of creation. Now, as we know, they decided to take the long way round. See, how do we look at mistakes? Do we see mistakes as the way that you are going to, that we're going to discover something more positive? That's, you know, it was the fact that the certain dish of something in the laboratory and it went moldy, that was the key to discovering penicillin. It's like when something goes wrong and in fact that becomes the key for something very good. So we've got the long way around, but the ultimate purpose is positive. So the way that the Midrash describes it, in that Midrash Rabbah on the Song of Songs, that line, Ba'ati Legani, they were there in the garden, and then came the error of eating from the tree of knowledge. It was an error. God said, don't eat from the tree of knowledge. It's not so simple. We'll look at what the Talmud says. We'll look at what the Zohar says. It's not just such a black and white thing. That's the force of Jewish tradition. Yes, it looks black and white, but actually it's not black and white. But anyway, there in the text of the Torah, it looks pretty black and white. There they're told, don't eat from this tree, and they did. And this was followed by more errors. Cain killed Abel, and then worse things, further things, violence, idolatry, the flood, all kinds of different things. And the Midrash describes how the divine presence withdrew from the world, and it describes seven levels of withdrawal, going away, away, away. In other words, becoming more and more hidden. The divine presence is more and more hidden. And then there's the road back. And the Midrash describes seven tzaddikim, seven righteous men, who began and... they began drawing the divine presence back into the world. Abraham, then his son Isaac, his son Jacob, his son Levi, his son Kahat, his son Amram, and then Moses. Now, it says righteous men. What about righteous women? It's very interesting that in the case of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Amram, and Moses, we know quite a lot about their wives are very, very significant people. Abraham, of course, there was Sarah, who was a tremendously powerful figure in the Torah. God tells Abraham, whatever Sarah tells you to do, just obey. So Isaac has his wife Rebecca, also someone who, as the story unfolds, knows better than a husband what should happen, who should get the blessing, whether it should be Jacob or Esau, and she wins, her view is carried through. Jacob has Leah and Rachel and Bilhah and Zilpah, and much of the whole life of Jacob is really his relationship with these four women. Levi, I don't know anything about the wife of Levi, nor of Kahat. Amram had a very famous wife called Yocheved. She was the little girl who was born just as Jacob and his family were entering Egypt. And Moses, of course, had the very phenomenal Zipporah, the daughter of Jethro. So when we talk about righteous men, there's always at least one righteous woman there as well. Now, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Levi, that's 4, 5, 6, 7. Moses was the seventh, and all sevenths are precious. Now, this idea, which is there in the discourse, and it's also mentioned somewhere else in the Midrash, that there is a power. Because Moshe was the seventh, he had the power to achieve the indwelling of godliness in the world. And there it was at Mount Sinai. This is a picture of the Sinai range. I've never actually been there myself. I knew a young woman. She went there as basically as a student. And she was so inspired just by the look of Mount Sinai, she decided she's going to find out something about her heritage, about Judaism, and she ended up living a very traditional Jewish life. She lives in Tzfat now in northern Israel. But she was just inspired by the physical image of being there at Mount Sinai. But at Sinai, the divine was revealed, as it will be, at the time of the Messiah. Now, it says that in Tanya, quoting the Zohar. That's a very interesting idea. Now, here we come to the problem. At Mount Sinai, it was such an intense experience, they couldn't really take it. There was their souls fled from them, they had to be revived. So you have the whole paradoxical intensity. In fact, then came a time of concealment, and during that time of Moses, and during that time of concealment, they made the golden calf. You know, so which one way of understanding it is they were so intensely over-radiated, as it were, by the intensity of the experience, that they could do things that were absolutely the wrong thing to do, completely the wrong thing to do. So there is that sense of paradox, and we are dealing, our whole situation is one of balancing the finite and the infinite dimensions of life and trying to bring them together in a wholesome way. But then comes the next step. Reenacting Sinai for all time. And that took place by the building of the sanctuary. God told Moses to tell the Jewish people to build the sanctuary. And that they built it actually at the foot of Mount Sinai. That's where they built the sanctuary. That was the prototype of the temple in Jerusalem. And Nachmanides explains that that was really a kind of a reenactment of Sinai. The Jewish people camped around the sanctuary with the divine presence in the Holy of Holies. That is like the Jewish people were around Mount Sinai and the presence of the divine there. So this is a continuous phenomenon of godliness being revealed. And as it says in Exodus, in section Truma, Va'asuli Mikdash, V'shachanti b'tocham. They should make for me a sanctuary, and I will dwell within them. Now, Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson, in the sixth Rebbe, he says in this discourse, which really is quoting earlier sources, it doesn't say b'tocho, within it, but within them, b'toch kol echad ve'achat, within each individual. The idea is the divine dwelling inside us. And that's what we are trying to do. That is where we have this quality of inner redemption. That there is the divine dwelling inside the person. And through the study of Torah, here we come back to the simple end statement. Through the study of Torah, observance of mitzvot, living a Jewish lifestyle, you know what the effect is inside the person? The divine dwells within each of us. in his or her inner mikdash, inner sanctuary, there is the divine dwelling inside us in an incredible way. It's something absolutely amazing. Now, what is amazing about it is because the concealment, the negativity of life, we could encapsulate it. I mean, this is a long discourse. It's a discourse with 20 chapters, and they're fascinating. Here's one point from the discourse. The sanctuary was made of planks of wood. A plank is called a keresh in Hebrew. Now, you can see very easily that the word keresh is the same letters as what word? Sheker. Sheker, falsehood. The whole problem of life is falsehood of one kind or another. And that quality of falsehood, what we are trying to do is take the falsehood and rearrange it. And just make, instead of shi'in kufresh, which is sheker, falsehood, it's rearranged. It's kufresh shi'in. It is a keresh. It's a plank in the sanctuary, a dwelling for the divine. So therefore what the purpose of life is to transform oneself, the community, society, the world, to make it all into a dwelling for the divine. So this transforming process, I think that that's the key. If it remains false, then the influx of infinite radiance is going to demolish it. It won't stand before that. But if there's some way that it can be rearranged, it's going to be able to take the infinity. That's the resolution of the paradox. That there's some kind of inner transformation within the individual and within the world which enables the finite to become a vessel for the infinite. That the finite becomes the point where godliness can dwell. All right, so now that leads, in a way, towards the Garden of Eden, again, writ large, that we have a global Garden of Eden, which has now been transformed in such a way that falsehood of existence has been transformed into something wholesome and positive, and godliness is revealed. Now let's step back into the Garden of Eden for a moment. And we're going to step back with two books under our arm. One book is the Talmud, the other is the Zohar, and we're going to see, look at this issue of eating from the tree of knowledge. They ate from the tree of knowledge too early. They were created on Erev Shabbat, on Friday, the sixth day of creation. That's when Adam was created first as one being, then divided in half, Adam and Eve. And so they ate from the tree of knowledge too early. If they had waited till Shabbat began, there would have been no problem. That's what the Talmud says. The Zohar goes a bit further. You know what the problem was? They should have eaten from the tree of life first. Eat from the tree of life, they'd have been able to remain in the garden, everything would have been okay. It's a matter of getting the balance of the tree of knowledge and the tree of life. Some kind of dimension of the way in which we absorb the spiritual. You see, in order for us to face this realm of holiness, we have to activate the spirituality inside us. Now, the tree of life, that activates that spirituality. We ourselves can eat from the tree of life in this sense. The Zohar describes the Kabbalistic tradition as the tree of life, Eitz Chaim. Study of these teachings expressed in an appropriate form helps each person, each man and woman, achieve the indwelling of the divine through the details of daily Jewish life. Daily Jewish life becomes the means through Shabbat, through Kashrut, through Mikvah, through Pesach. That becomes the means for a spiritual indwelling within the person, given a little bit of extra sense of the knowledge of the purpose, the atmosphere, the kavanah, the beauty, the radiance which is there within the mitzvot. And that ultimately is the way that we deconstruct the divide. The Torah tells of the error of eating from the tree of knowledge at the wrong time, the power of sin, right? Sin is very negative. In Hebrew, the word chet, sin, actually comes from a word which means to miss something. There's something they could have achieved and they missed it. That's what a sin is. It's missing something. The Kabbalists speak of the power of holiness and repentance. So sin can be transformed into repentance. And holiness is a way in which the person climbs, in a sense, away from sin to a higher, more spiritual level. The Baal Shem Tov, he takes a new perspective. He speaks of the power of the spirituality within each individual, wherever they are. They may at this moment actually be sinning in some way. They may be doing something wrong. But within them there is a glow, a beautiful glow of radiance, which if you can find that radiance, and if they can find that radiance, the illumination of the Baal Shem Tov's teaching, bringing these Kabbalistic traditions together in his own teachings. And maybe you remember, he had this mystical experience where the Messiah said to him, he asked the Messiah, when will the Messiah come? And he said, when your fountains burst forth to the outside, enabling each person to discover this spirituality within themselves. Now that leads to, we've nearly finished now, that leads to two possibilities, which are both very important. The first is what's called the private redemption. The individual achieves a level of inner spiritual liberation, which can be described as a personal redemption. There you are at the center of the circle, the individual within himself or herself. And in a way, that's the immediate field where we are working. That's prayer, that's Jewish life, that's the Seder night. You know, the Seder night, with all the work involved, it can actually be an ecstatic experience as well. So, somewhere. So. But that leads to the general redemption. The temple is rebuilt in Jerusalem. The Jewish people as a whole return to Jewish life. They're free from any kind of oppression. There's peace in the whole world. And the Gentiles keep the seven Noahide laws. It's a tremendous, tremendous transformation. And that comes about through the private redemption. The personal, individual qualities of inner liberation, having a Jewish lifestyle for oneself and one's family, reaching out to others in the Jewish community, that leads towards the general redemption. And part of the process is the awareness of the direction and the goal, the kavanah. One can keep Jewish life just in a sort of a self-centered pleasure principle focus, but in fact, if we are aware of the kavanah, if we're aware of the direction, yearning for the redemption is repeatedly expressed in our prayers and in the forthcoming Seder night celebration. L'shana haba b'Yerushalayim. Next year in Jerusalem. Thank you. Okay, well, I'd just like to mention that these talks are actually on the web. The four that we've had so far are on the web. And